Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour following news, a Simon Hollis conversation with Spartans hockey coach Tom Anastas, and a look at Ford's Blueprint for Sustainability. And Jack Lessenberry comments on our sustainable future on Earth.
This sounds very simplistic and comic book, but if we destroy the planet, we all die. We destroy the Great Lakes, we all die. We destroy the air, we all die. That should be sort of the bottom line. Don't follow your own nest. If this wasn't a public radio station, I could say it much more graphically. We all know what we're talking about. That should be the bottom line.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR starts after this news.
Now listen, you guys, you know what? Normal kids would have been stoked to slack off, but not you guys, because you're not normal. You're special. And because I think you guys have the right attitude, I think it's time we started our new class project.
A science project?
No, it's called
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, Russ and I are just outside of Lansing at the Ingham County Fairgrounds at the 2016 Sustainable Living Summit. And a new feature, it's a brand new feature of the Michigan Energy Fair, which is hosted by our friends at the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association. And what better way to kick off this week's program than to interview the keynote speaker of the Sustainable Living Summit, much honored and highly respected journalist and political analyst Jack Lessenberry. Jack, we just listened to your keynote address, and I'd like to start where you started with this whole notion of where we are with respect to the climate change, the global warming debate. 97-98% of the science indicates that humans are causing a good deal of this. Your take on all of that?
I think to deny climate change at this point is like denying that the world is round. And we're not getting very much by squabbling about to what percentage humans are responsible for it. We just have to figure out the best way of dealing with it so we have a sustainable future on this planet.
You told a story when you were an editor down in Memphis, a young politician came in to talk to you about issues related to global warming and climate change. Could you tell our listeners that story as well?
Well, one day this fellow came, I knew of him, of course. He was sitting in my office, and he wanted to talk to me about the ozone layer. He was Al Gore. At the time, he was just a freshman senator. He was important, but not as important as he later became. I was very impressed by him. He was much less stiff. We think of Al Gore as being this kind of stiff politician who lost the presidential election in part because of that. But he was very warm, and he was a man. I thought that he really was a teacher at heart rather than a politician. He clearly believed this and had studied very hard and did the science on it. And I think you might even argue, whatever your politics, that he may have done a better service for the world by going on the focus on the environment rather than staying in politics and running for president again.
You said something there that's almost an anomaly, a politician who knew his science. We have so many of these issues, biotechnology, climate change, that get politicized, but they get politicized without any reference to the science whatsoever.
Well, you know, we are sort of a nation that is ignorant of science, and that's always been the case, but I think back when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, when we were in this enormous space race competition with the Soviet Union, we at least thought we should know science. We thought we should do better. And I think the biggest, most astounding thing for me about what's happened is that we sort of don't care about science anymore, and we don't even make a pretense of trying to pay attention to it, when it now is clearly more important than ever. Anybody, you know, you and I spend a fair amount of time up north. You see what it's doing to the lakes. You see what it's doing to climate. You see, a few years ago on Lake Michigan, where I have a place, there are all these dead cormorants. We have to worry about these things for the future, and we have to figure out, you know, the problem is not to fix the blame, to fix the problem.
My guest is Jack Lessenberry. You can find him on television, on the radio, in the newspapers. He's ubiquitous. Jack, you also talked about some legislation in Michigan that relates to Michigan's energy portfolio, Michigan's energy future. We did hit our 10% renewable by 2015, but we don't have any mandates going forward. I mean, Talk about the legislation that you discussed specifically and our energy future in Michigan in general.
Well, there are two bills right now before the legislature, very controversial bills, SB for Senate Bill 437 and 438. Okay. They talk about renewable energy, but basically these are the bills that the major utilities, primarily DTE and Consumers Energy, want passed. The utilities say this will make sure we have reliability. We won't run out of energy. But a lot of other people think that it inhibits things like solar energy, that these bills inhibit alternative energy sources, and they give the utilities sort of a monopoly mandate, more of one than they have now, for in perpetuity. And I don't know that we really should feel comfortable about trusting utilities, about limiting ourselves to certain sources of energy. And again, they don't have any mandate. Well, in our experience, if you don't have a mandate, these things just become theoretical and people don't do them. We didn't have really much progress on pollution before we got the EPA, the Environmental Protection Administration. And I think that anybody should not take my word for it. They should look at these bills carefully, talk to experts, and figure out, do these make the most sense for Michigan? And there are a number of people, both on the right, sort of libertarian sorts of people in the legislature, Gary Glenn, State Representative Gary Glenn, for one, who may be the next chair of the Energy Committee, and on the left, who think these bills are not a good thing. But the utilities have a lot of money, a lot of lobbyists, and they are formidable competitors.
Yeah, one group that typically votes Republican but is for opening up that 10% mandate, agricultural interests, because Michigan farmers pay more for their energy than farmers in virtually every Midwest state, and some of the highest amount of energy costs in the nation. They want to see that 10% cap lifted on outside providers. And so that speaks to your point about strange bedfellows sometimes that politics make.
You have to be creative. You care about things like sustainability and energy. You've got to sometimes put together odd coalitions, odd bedfellows, and not worry too much about. You can put together coalitions on a particular issue you might not be able to assemble on other issues. And we have, you know, Michigan State University was founded because of it used to be called the College of Agriculture and Applied Sciences in 1855. And we sometimes forget how important agriculture is to this state. And you see things, I mean, we almost had this disastrous trade legislation last year where Canada was going to impose enormous sanctions on Michigan agriculture that they ended up repealing at the last moment. So I think it's a very legitimate thing. And farmers are terribly important. And farmers these days often get overlooked.
Jack, we talked about Michigan's energy future. We talked a little bit about climate change. Congress is sending to President Obama's desk a measure that's going to strengthen pipeline oversight and hopefully strengthen, ultimately, pipeline security. In the meantime, the Michigan Task Force on Pipelines is sort of dilly-dallying around. The federal legislation, as I understand it, would perhaps usurp any ultimate state legislation. Why is the state dragging its heels?
Well, I think that there are certain moneyed interests that have a vested interest in us dragging our heels. In the last couple of years, we've all of a sudden discovered that there's this pipeline, Canadian-based company called Enbridge, has this oil pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. If that pipeline were a human being, it would be old enough to collect Social Security at 63 years old. If that pipeline were to break, Lake Huron and Lake Michigan might essentially be destroyed. It's not too strong to say that. And nevertheless, apparently the state and the federal government don't have the right to inspect it. The company maintains that they're inspecting it. And because this is the same company that 6 years ago had this pipeline break in the Kalamazoo River. And when the alarms went off, they thought that what it meant was their destruction, so they forced even more oil through it. It cost $1 billion or so to clean that up. But that was a feather in the wind compared to what would happen if this Pipeline 5 broke. Now, I'm not trying to be sensationalist or alarmist, but at the very least, we ought to have, this is a public, national, federal property. We ought to have the ability to inspect and regulate it and decide for the future, is this really the best way that we should have beginning our oil? You know, and think about, we need to have laws in place that will protect our safety.
Now, it is encouraging that in the U.S. House and Senate, Boyce votes to pass that legislation. So there was a lot of bipartisan support on that pipeline security bill. But we just can't seem to get that kind of consensus here in Michigan.
Well, of course, if you can get it to the floor, if you can get a floor vote, who's going to say, are you going to vote again? Are you going to vote in favor of maybe having the pipeline break and kill us all? Nobody's going to vote. But there, these people are very shrewd. Lobbyists are very shrewd. They don't want to ever bring it to a vote. But they want to have something so watered down that says, oh, we vote in favor of Enbridge, maybe please inspecting the pipe if they feel like it. You know, you've got to push. And the whole key, I think, is public awareness of what's going on. If you went up to people, if you went to Frandor, you just went to the mall, and you asked people, do you think there should be an unregulated pipeline under the Great Lakes that if it breaks will destroy the Great Lakes? You would have a unanimous agreement. God, no. But they have a way of kind of fuzzing the issue. My guess is that before 24 months ago, nobody knew that pipeline was there.
The election, the national election. Looks like Trump versus Clinton for sure. In terms of environmental and sustainability issues, there seems to be a very clear path or a very clear choice here between the two presumptive candidates.
As far as I can tell, Donald Trump, who is a presumptive Republican nominee, hasn't given a lot of time or said a lot about the environment other than that business should do whatever it likes. It doesn't seem to be a major issue for him. Now, of course, some people, certainly in Michigan, people had a raised eyebrow about Hillary Clinton in a debate with Bernie Sanders. She essentially said that she was unwilling to oppose fracking. So I don't think either of these candidates has a perfect record, but one candidate essentially has a record of sort of no environmental record at all. So I think this is something that ought to concern people. It's basically, this sounds very simplistic and comic book, but if we destroy the planet, we all die. If we destroy the Great Lakes, we all die. If we destroy the air, we all die. That should be sort of the bottom line, you know. Don't follow your own nest. If this wasn't a public radio station, I could say it much more graphically. We all know what we're talking about. That should be the bottom line. And I think as the world population gets bigger, you and I can remember a time when they told us there were 2 billion people in the world. It's approaching 7 billion people now. I mean, you don't have to have passed calculus at the School of Engineering at MSU to realize the tremendous drain on resources and water and oxygen this all entails.
Do you think we're going to hear much about the environment in this election?
We might. All it would take is one big environmental disaster, and we might hear about it. You never think about air unless you can't get any, and then you think about nothing else. So on one hand, you certainly hope you don't want another Bhopal, or you don't want another Chernobyl, anything like that. But people really need to be concerned about these things. The thing is, you never know what the future is going to be. The one prediction I will very confidently make about this election is that there will be one or more huge issues that will influence it that we know nothing about right now. But you and I spent our, you also are, I can tell you're almost 40 years old. You and I spent our childhood tucking ourselves under a desk as a rehearsal for what would happen when the nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union broke out, and having teachers tell us we need to get our parents to build bomb shelters. That seems like ancient history. It seems like the Crusades now. So, but what we do know is we're still going to have problems of sustainability and worrying about the environment. And sooner, I think, if we don't do a whole lot more, we're going to be in a whole lot more trouble.
Among the many hats you wear, you're also head of the journalism department at Wayne State University. I'm a proud alum. I did my master's degree down at Wayne State. I'm very fond of that institution. Young people now getting into journalism who may have a passion for sustainability, science, journalism, what have you, what does the future hold for them? And what do you find when you talk to those students about their values and their idealism?
People are very gloomy about journalism these days, and it's certainly undeniable that the number of jobs in conventional media, newspapers especially, has shrunk. We try to train people to be communicators, and certainly environmental organizations need communicators. universities, which are big think tanks, they need to have people that can get their message out and deal with the press and work on blogs. So I think that there really is a bright future. We have to be a little more sometimes creative in how we make a living. Thomas Friedman, the great multiple Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from the New York Times, a couple of years ago I was talking to him at the Mackinac Conference, and he said, he's a year younger than me, we're both old, and he said, you and I had to get out of school and find a job. These kids today, our children, have to get out of school and create a job. So you have to be entrepreneurial. I mean, that's absolutely right. But you also have to be committed that we get into journalism because we want to find out stuff and tell people about it. Now, the format of that's going to change. The medium might change. But the need for journalism, in my view, is greater than ever, and especially in this era of the environment.
Where is the editorial control? Who's going to read? What about accuracy? What about truth, veracity?
Well, this is a problem. It's a problem that at all our universities, we have to teach critical thinking skills. And the problem is a lot of people can't distinguish between the New York Times online and Joe's Basement blog. And so we have to turn out educated people. And educated people means people who are not just technicians. You know, if you're going to be a journalist, I want you also to have a background in history. I want you to have a background in science and the environment. I want you to know how to challenge and dispute claims. And you need to commit yourself to sort of lifelong learning. I constantly learn stuff that I don't know. I think that anybody who wants to be a good journalist or really a good citizen should always be slightly neurotic that they don't know enough about anything. And I find that whenever I assume that I know something, that is when I tend to get in trouble.
I always go back to my philosophy classes at Albion, the great Socratic axiom, I know that I know not.
Well, I know that I know not, but also I know that I need to know. There are people who are telling you that it's just fine that you know not. They want to give you the mushroom treatment. And I think we all need to commit ourselves to continuing to learn and continuing to try to make this a better world.
On that note and on that optimistic note, it's been a pleasure talking with Jack Lessenberry, well-known and highly honored journalist and political commentator. Jack, not only a pleasure talking to you, but a pleasure meeting you.
It's really been an honor to be here. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis welcome Spartans hockey coach Tom Anastas to the program. Here's President Simon.
So it's a pleasure to welcome our hockey coach, Tom Anastas. Tom, it's we were talking about the role of sport and how it's really important to develop young people. And I know that you're passionate about the game, but you're really an educator at heart. And how does that philosophy sort of play out for you as you think about the off season?
Well, in so many different ways. I know myself, I always talk about my locker room MBA because you learn so many lessons playing in sports, and especially team sports. Oftentimes, I know during my professional career, having the opportunity to work with and hire people, you look for certain attributes that are fostered in a sports environment, whether it's leadership, whether it's teamwork, whether it's kind of putting others before your own interests, work ethic, managing time. All of those things are things we talk about with our prospects and with our players repeatedly. And it's interesting, in our recruiting, we recruit so young today. You're sitting there with parents. It's important to them that they're kind of passing their kids on to an environment that goes beyond sport.
It's really become a trend in many sports where I'm going to use the word unfortunately, we have to start the conversations at a younger and younger age. You almost want to hand the recruit some cotton candy while you're talking to them about coming to a campus, not just Michigan State, but it's the norm that's out there. And talk about how challenging that is a little bit on the you've maybe had it a little bit more than some of the other sports, but others are, I think now are coming to you of how have you handled this?
Well, it's very difficult. I wish it wasn't what it was. I think it started in our particular sport because of the competition we have with Canadian Major Junior Hockey. Where
Which kids, is unique. Very, any NCAA sport, that's a unique situation.
It really is. Kids are forced, and that's how this all started. Kids are forced to make a decision on an NCAA educational path to compete in the sport or the Canadian Hockey League path when they're essentially 15, 16 years old. So our sport started down that road several years ago to deal with that, but now it's crept beyond that. And to give you an example, I had a call yesterday from an advisor who has a 2001 birth year goaltender who's excellent, but they're a 2001 birth year. And that's three goalies from now right. for us. And it has really created a challenging dynamic, not in just projecting talent, much like you do with a pro organization when you're drafting players, but also waiting till they're ready. So the irony in our sport, as crazy as this is the average entry-level age of a kid now is over 20 years old, and yet we're recruiting them younger. So we're recruiting them younger, they're committing younger. We have to continue to recruit till they finally get here, which is inching closer to 21 years old.
I noticed Roy had the NHL draft on for a bit. And there was one player drafted out of the junior program that was committed to go to East Coast University for a couple of years, probably, in order to fine tune their skills, because the team was reputedly didn't have an immediate space for him, and he was a high draft choice, so he would have had a guaranteed contract, but it was almost as if college was a parking place for that development, and in order to avoid, keep a high draft choice, avoid the contract, the salary that went with that, and at the same time recognize that he was probably a one and done, maybe a two and done at the most as a hockey player. Is that also a new phenomenon?
You know, it is something. It's emerged and it's changed a little bit over the years. Prior to the NHL enacting an entry-level salary cap or their overall salary cap, kids who came into college were affordable draft picks for NHL clubs because they didn't have to get them under contract early. They could allow them to sit in college for 4 years, develop their maturity both physically and socially, and then bring them out when they felt they were ready, oftentimes after their fourth year. Well, over a period of time, we don't have the issue of probably one-and-done mentality like you do in basketball because it's very difficult for an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old to step into the NHL and play. There's not many who do. And yet the entry-level salary cap is so tight that it's really a nominal investment that an NHL club has to make in a player if they choose to sign him. So we've actually, as a result of probably the 2005 CBA, we're seeing more kids leave school early as a result of that.
A couple off-the-ice things that I'd like to walk through is one, scheduling. And you look at the Big Ten Conference, which was a dramatic shift, I think, for all six members. Penn State sort of forced the hand by starting a hockey program. There was a national changeup. You now have six Big Ten institutions that are competing, adding Notre Dame to that. Talk about the dynamics a little bit of what that Big Ten transition, the impact that that had on maybe the six schools, but also the addition of Notre Dame to the schedule.
Well, the six schools previously, being divided amongst leagues, didn't beat each other up, essentially, and made an impact in the respective leagues they were in, and more teams therefore got into the NCAA tournament. So, you know, in theory, when you have the structure that we have, once you get into conference play, your conference is essentially going to be 500, as is most conferences. So it really makes a greater emphasis on your non-conference scheduling. And so when we all got into it, the landscape was changing so dramatically. There were some leagues even discussing the idea of not scheduling certain schools or certain leagues, affiliating in non-conference schedule. So we had to get out front of that and put a schedule in place. Since the dust has settled, we are now in a better place to kind of look at the scheduling landscape. Probably, I don't want to say more strategically, because we were strategic at that time, but strategic in a different way. And I think as a conference, we can look at things a little bit differently as we move forward. Now, Notre Dame will reduce the number of non-conference games that we'll have to schedule, which will be positive. And I think it brings some geography that fits, which makes sense, too, from a travel perspective. So I think that's a real good addition to the hockey conference. And, you know, we're looking to try to continue to have a national flavor to our hockey schedule, and yet play, you know, competitive teams from each of the conferences to try to enhance our RPI to the best we can.
Pairwise is a formula that's used. It's similar to an RPI, but it pretty much determines who's in the NCAA tournament. Does the pairwise provide the opportunity for teams playing in the Big Ten Conference in that competitive environment to be able to have success in the NCAA selection process?
Well, I think it puts a lot of emphasis on your success in non-conference play. And I think that has caused pause to kind of look at things, because if you look at some of the traditional schools ourselves, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, generally speaking, along with, say, Boston College, maybe BU, we've been generally younger teams over the history of our game in the last 30 years. And the game or teams generally have gotten a lot older. And so now we've really backloaded our schedule to conference play. And yet there's such a huge emphasis on that non-conference to build that pairwise. And so we have to look at our schedule a little differently. If our teams are going to be a little bit younger, maybe we need to spread that out a little bit, because as your teams are trying to grow together during the early portions of the years, season, and you're playing older teams, you're probably at a disadvantage as your team is trying to mature. So that's really caught our attention here. We've got to take a different approach to it, both in our recruiting and putting our teams together in our preparation for the early season games. We're also going to explore with other leagues the idea of some scheduling relationships. So other leagues who may have an odd number like we do. So now that we have an odd number, when Notre Dame enters the league, that means every school will have a bye, you know, at least one week at a time. So that's something that has to be addressed as well. But I think the scheduling approach has certainly changed over the past few years.
The passing of Ron Mason, you've made comments, you played for Coach, you coached with Coach, and have had a long relationship. Obviously came as a shock to all of us. Reflect a little bit on Coach Mace.
Very shocking. To this day, I received an email from an alumnus yesterday who hardly played but was impacted by Coach Mason. But everybody, you know, continues to be shocked because it just kind of came out of the blue. Last we saw him, he was bouncing around the arena, you know, with the normal level of energy he always has. But, you know, it was interesting at the funeral service. I thought there was a great turnout of former players. And I think he impacted a lot of people in the sport. He obviously inspired a lot of coaches who are in the game, like myself, but impacted a lot of players over a lot of years. I saw players from his early Bowling Green years that I know. I don't know if there was anybody here from when he coached at Lake Superior. I didn't recognize any of those folks. But I thought the tribute that took place on our campus and the job the staff did in preparing for that in very short order was very appropriate and the way I saw it is if he were walking out of there, he would have felt real good about it.
No, I think it's the shock is I think for all of us, if you were to pick a 75-year-old in the scheme of things, in terms of activity level, mental acuity, you know, planning ahead for life, you know, and any variable mm-hmm. you would use, Ron would be in the top 1% of America, you would feel, in all of those factors. So it's a lesson for all of us that that these surprises do happen, but they also provide an opportunity to reflect and recognize greatness in many, many forms.
He sure did enjoy life. He was, every day was complete.
He did. he did for sure, and I think he probably went the way he would have picked out to go. But, you know, everybody was very shocked by the sudden news of it, and I think that's a great point that you make. And I look at Pat Summitt, who passed away at 64, and yet she's been having health issues, and I didn't know Coach Summitt, but at the same time, people knew that was kind of coming, so you could kind of prepare for it. Yet in this case, I think that was very shocking to everybody.
But I do agree with you. If there were a list that you could, Ron could have picked about, he may not have picked the location,
right?
But he would have picked the method, mm-hmm. and that should be a comfort to all of us as well.
Let's talk about the future. This offseason, preparing for next year, as we go into the next campaign, what's happening this summer? Who's coming in? What type of talent do you see becoming Spartan hockey players?
We have a large group coming in, actually larger than we were hopeful for back 5 years ago. And my first year, I lost 11 players, and we tried to put this plan together between transfers and such to try to reduce that number. But given time, early exits to the pros, injuries, red shirts, we're back to a number of 10. Not all are scholarship athletes, but it's a very good class academically. It's without a doubt our most talented group. Our skill level has come up significantly, which is really positive. We're going to be inexperienced, you know, particularly early, as these players are going to be plugged into some important roles, but they'll gain experience, very good work ethic, very good character, a lot of leadership. Although it's a young group, I think we've had a number of guys who were captains of their teams, some of which were captains of international teams that they played on. And so we're excited about that. But I'm really excited about the character and talent and skill level of what we have. The hockey IQ is very strong pretty much across the board. And goal scoring. We have some goal scoring that we haven't had here in a little while. And we need that desperately. So it'll take some guys some time to adjust to this level of hockey. But we have some guys who were top 10 scorers in their leagues where they came out of. And we expect they'll do the same here.
You have leaders in Kelly Miller and Tom Newton on the coaching staff. But when you look at the team, when you look at the individuals that are on the ice, who will be your leaders out on the rink, those that are returning?
Well, Joe Cox is really he'll be our captain returning, and he really sets a high leadership standard. We've been very comfortable with him. We knew when he came here he had that potential. Michael Ferrantino, I thought, was an excellent leader as well, and they worked very closely together, really preparing Joe for where he will be now. So he'll be a main guy, and I think that we're going to be watching a couple guys in particular over the course of the next 4 months to see how they adapt to a different role now that they're gaining experience. And we had a Mason Appleton last year, was an excellent freshman. I expect he'll take a huge step in his game. Even as a freshman, he showed a ton of leadership. He pushed guys hard as a freshman, which isn't all that common. Mm-hmm. And he's a real student of the game as well. So I think he has the potential to really impact a lot of guys around him. And I know one player in particular who chose to come to school. One of the reasons he chose is that I have an opportunity to play with him.
What about goaltending?
Goaltending, we're having a big change, obviously. Jake Hildebrand has been the steady force in there for four seasons. And Ed Minnie, who hasn't had a lot of opportunity to play, played for the U.S. national team, has really progressed. We really like how he progressed last year. But, frankly, we got him a little experience, but we could not – I couldn't justify not playing your best player every night we could. He's having a productive off season so far, as I understand it. He's a big guy, so he'll have a much different style than we're used to seeing in an athletic type Jake Hildebrand. He's a big 6'5", 215-pound guy. And then we have another guy who's going to come in and really push him, John Letheman. He's got a great history of being on winning teams, and in many cases he played on weaker teams, and he really carried the mail. He won a state championship several years ago. Tom Newton's brother, Bill Newton, was the coach of the high school team he played for in Michigan, and had great success and went on to junior hockey, had great success again. Big guy, kind of the prototypical goalie you see in the NHL today at 6'2", 6'3". So I think we'll be good in goal. We'll be inexperienced to start the season, but we're very confident that that will be a position of strength for us. You know, one of the challenges we had last year is due to an injury and early departure, our defense was kind of handcuffed all season long. We didn't have numbers, didn't have strength in numbers, didn't have depth and experience. Okay. This year we won't have tons of experience, but we'll have depth. And a little different dynamic that we've been waiting for. We've got some guys who can really skate back there, some guys who have the potential to add to the offensive productivity. We do go to North Dakota, who's the defending national champs. So that'll be an environment that I think will be a tournament-type environment for our team to see a crowd of 12,000 people against a very skilled, very talented team who can play very physical, especially at home. So I think that will be a good opportunity. And we'll also play Denver at home, who's got a very talented, very skilled team. So the preseason, or I should call it non-conference season schedule, will be something that fans will really enjoy and will be a great test for our team.
Yeah, facilities are a little bit upgrades, and you got a little bit more work to do.
We do. The upgrades to date have been outstanding, actually. That's got to be a priority of mine in the summer here, is get out and help the fundraising efforts to get that next step. But I will tell you, one prospect in particular who is a very high-profile prospect that's joining our team this upcoming year, was here. He played for the national team, was here the previous year, and the facility changes that were made, from the glass and boards to the lights to the seating to the electronics and video boards, made a huge impact on him. And that's what we're competing against today. So we've got to continue to work on it. But I think our building, especially considering it's a 40-year-old building, is showing very well. But I will tell you, having traveled to Greece and Italy and seen some of their properties that have been there for centuries and centuries, our building looks pretty darn good for only 40 years old.
It's one of the great rinks to watch a game, and I think there's really always ways to improve, especially some of the things we want to do for student athletes. But one of the great rinks and one of the great environments in history of the college game.
Without a doubt, one of the things we do with prospects is we take them right down the ice level, and it's neat because the fans sit right on top of you. It's a nice sized building, and yet it's got that cozy feeling when you're a player because the fans are right there. They feel like it's a part of it. So, we have a great home. We get great response from the people who come to our building, and I think the upgrades have been terrific.
Well, it's been great to have you here. We're looking forward to another exciting season. Thank you for all that you do, not just for hockey, but for our athletic department, our campus, and community. It's good to have all your kids running around here all the time, and they're always a bright smile to encounter. So thanks for being part of Team MSU.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Spartans hockey coach Tom Anastas talking with Spartans athletic director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University president Luana K. Simon. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, Ford has released its 17th annual sustainability report for 2015 and 2016. And here again to give us a few highlights is John Vieira. John is the Global Director of Sustainability for the Ford Motor Company. John, it's been about a year. It's always great to have you back on the program.
Love to be on the program, Kirk. Thanks for having me again.
Last year, we talked a little bit about Ford's Smart Mobility Plan, which I know you've designed to help solve some of the most complex mobility problems that we're going to be facing, not only now, but down the road. This year, the report featured something right there at your world headquarters called Dynamic Shuttle, a couple of programs in London. Talk to us a little bit about the importance of mobility and then in general, and then those programs in particular.
Yeah, fantastic, Kurt. So the importance of mobility, Mark Fields, it's probably been about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, when he came out and said, we not only need to be a traditional automotive company and producing cars and trucks, but we want to be a mobility company as well. And so we created this Ford Smart Mobility. And, the concept around being a mobility company and what Ford Smart Mobility is all about, it's just, moving people, right? Moving people and goods, but in particular people. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean that the people have to own a vehicle in order to be able to move. As a matter of fact, with congestion and other things, it's going to be important to move people with not everybody owning a vehicle. So we have a couple of several concepts that, we're actually working on right now and actually implementing right now. And the one that you brought up, the dynamic shuttle that we have on the Ford campus, we have a fairly large campus here in Dearborn. And the concept is, why don't we use, this very creative dynamic shuttle to move our employees around? And it's a matter of, we have an app that you could actually get on and, ask for the shuttle and tell them, what time it needs to actually come to get you. And it's just a very efficient way of, it's like hailing a cab, or this time it's a shuttle, to get you from one Ford location within Dearborn to another. And it's just a fantastic concept that clearly we would be able to apply, I'm going to call it, to the general public.
And then, so that's close to home on your campus in Dearborn. What about these programs over in jolly old England?
Yeah, so since we're a global company, we said, let's not just restrict some of this mobility fund to the Dearborn area. And so you mentioned Go Park and Go Drive. So Go Park is like a predictive parking system that actually directs, if you're using this application, it actually directs, our customers to open parking spaces. And, one of the big concerns, Kirk, in large cities throughout the world, and London's no different, people could spend a tremendous amount of time looking for parking spaces, right? So that's not only a waste of their time, they're actually emitting, right, clearly more emissions looking around. So having this type of a smart application is really valuable for the people's time, but also for the environment. And then we have another application that we call Go Drive, and it's a car sharing program, right? And it basically provides vehicles, to people. Yeah, they have guaranteed parking spots. There's these guaranteed locations, and it just makes it very easy to get around without having to own a vehicle, but basically handle, all of your transportation needs through this particular system.
John, as one who's had the great misfortune of driving in towns like London and Rome and Paris, I can really appreciate what you're talking about. How much of this mobility issue is driven by this demographic where we're seeing all over the world more and more people moving from rural areas into urban areas?
It's a great point, because that is the key issue. And we talk about, the Londons, we talk about New York and L.A., but if you go to, some of the other emerging countries throughout the world, in China, the big cities in China and in India, you are seeing, a tremendous amount of people moving into the urban areas, because the urban areas, number one, have jobs, but they also have, that's where all the goods and services are. So you could imagine that if everybody was just purchasing vehicles and trying to get into and move around the cities with their own vehicles, you would have even more gridlock than we have today. So when you think about these ride-sharing principles, what that allows you to do is to have folks be able to move around, but you're clearly going to be reducing the number of vehicles, you know, let's say within a city, because you're going to have people sharing those vehicles.
Yeah, and not only from the international standpoint to relieve congestion, which you've just mentioned, but a lot of these millennials, and you know the psychographics on that, they don't necessarily want to own vehicles, but they certainly are in a hurry to get from here to there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I talked about the congestion piece, and I think what you're referring to is particularly what we see in the U.S. and in the millennials, you know, the younger kids that, you know, are coming out of school and moving into the city, they don't see a need to have a vehicle. Clearly, they're going to want to get around, but they don't see a need to have a vehicle. So just putting congestion aside, you know, for those individuals, for that group of folks, you know, they're interested in getting around but not having to own a vehicle. And clearly, this type of a setup satisfies their needs as well.
What do you see? I mean, you've mentioned some of these major issues, but, I mean, what do you see are the major challenges in addressing these mobility problems?
Yeah, well, I think some of the major challenges are, you know, number one, you're going to want to be able to provide affordable mobility, right? So it's not just about, okay, it's a ride-sharing program, and it's, you know, there's these different models of moving people around, but it has to be affordable. We talked about the millennials. I mean, they're going to want affordable transportation. But again, when you think globally, in a lot of these, you know, countries that the population is exploding, particularly in cities, you know, the disposable income they have is not very high. They still have the need to move. So how do you come up with these solutions that are very, very affordable, right, and provide them to the communities, but at the same time, clearly we're a business that needs to make money. So, you know, that's one of the big challenges we're going to have.
Ford is America's top seller of plug-in hybrids. And you're going to, according to the sustainability report, you're going to add a few more to the electric vehicle portfolio.
Yes, you know, absolutely. And I appreciate the fact of you mentioning that, you know, we are the top seller of plug-in vehicles. So that's both our plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. We have a Fusion Energy and a C-Max Energy, but then also our full battery electric Focus. So, you know, what our plan is, Kurt, moving forward, I mean, we've actually announced the fact that we're going to invest an additional $4.5 billion, yep, that's right, billion dollars, through 2020. And our plan is that we're actually going to add 13 electrified vehicles basically to our portfolio. So clearly we're aggressively moving in that electrified vehicle space, you know, with this announcement and a lot of the work that I clearly see us doing within the company.
As you know, people who have electric vehicles or who are advocates of electric vehicles, you've had the opportunity to see some of the issues that have arisen. Even those of us who love the vehicles would like to see a little bit more range on those batteries. And I know part of what you're doing is investing in battery research technology at the University of Michigan. What do you see as the batteries of the future?
Yeah, no, you know, Kirk, it's spot on. And, you know, kind of talking about Michigan and, you know, you mentioning the fact this collaboration we have with the University of Michigan, you know, there's a $2.1 million investment that was made just in the battery labs at Michigan. And, you know, it's really going to be all about it's the energy density in those batteries. So you mentioned the fact that, boy, you know, I'd like to see more range. So, you know, how do you improve that energy density such that you don't have to, you could actually shrink the size of the battery, but at the same time, really increase the density to allow you to drive farther. And that's really the focus, one of the key focuses we have working with U of M and the battery lab.
Well, it sounds like a redo of the whole computer age technology, where we went from those big dinosaur computers to what we have now that we hold in our hands.
It's a perfect analogy. That is a perfect analogy. And we're aggressively going after it, and a lot of others are as well. So, you know, I applaud, you know, any efforts by any entity that's really trying to move the needle on battery technology, because we'll all benefit from it.
Let's go back to the millennials we talked about just a few moments ago. You know what they want in terms of mobility. You know that a lot of them are pretty green. How do these millennials feel about the future of battery technology?
Well, I think they're excited about it because, like you mentioned, the millennials are much more environmentally conscious, number one. I think, secondly, they're also very tech savvy. So when you think about battery electric vehicles and you know, a lot of what you can do with battery electric vehicles, they like the tech savvy piece as well. So, you know, there's a couple of elements of attraction that those millennials have around electric vehicles.
John, we've got a minute left, but I'd also not want to fail to mention the ongoing work in recycling and water use. We just talked to one of your engineers about CO2 capture to make foam parts and plastic parts for your vehicles, but you continue to make progress and benchmark in those areas as well.
Yeah, we absolutely do, and I think that's a great story where we're capturing that CO2 and making plastic parts, and recycling's a big deal. And the one thing I do want to mention, Kurt, that's very tangible here in Michigan, you know, at our Dearborn plant that produces our F-150, you know that it's made out of aluminum, and, you know, actually we take recycling seriously there. We actually have, that plant produces 20 million pounds of aluminum scrap per month. We completely recycle all 20 million pounds of that aluminum, and that recycled aluminum by itself produces 30,000 new pickup trucks. So we're completely recycling all the aluminum within that plant, and that's the concept that we're trying to drive throughout the company.
Way back to when Bill Ford read Cradle to Cradle, and you guys have been moving forward ever since.
That is the definition of Cradle to Cradle. That's exactly it, Kurt.
Well, John, it's always a pleasure. We could talk for another hour, but I always appreciate your time, and it's always so exciting to grab your sustainability report. This time it's the 17th for 2015 and 2016. Some wonderful reading there. I encourage our listeners to go to your website, or they can just Google the sustainability report for Ford.
Absolutely.
I've been talking with John Vieira. John is the Global Director of Sustainability for the Ford Motor Company. John, always a pleasure having you on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks so much, Kurt, and looking forward to talking to you in the future.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.